Hello and welcome to Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. I am Richard Moore and I am with Lionel Burney.
Good evening, Richard.
And for the last time on this Tour de France, Daniel Freeb.
Hi, Richard.
Final podcast, Daniel. Are you feeling emotional?
No, not really.
Tired?
Yeah, slightly.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we'll miss him, won't we? We'll miss Daniel.
I think we'll definitely miss Daniel. Absolutely. Lionel, where are we?
We are in Vaison-la-Romaine, which is where the press room was for the media who didn't want to go up the mountain.
And is Davis Cups one here?
No Davis Cups one here. It's I don't know even what this building is. It's a technical centre of some description. That's what it says on the gate, but I don't know. There's a sort of an athletics track and some kind of sports field.
And there's a huge mountain just behind the sports field.
Which is where we've just come from, isn't it? Mont Ventoux is prominent on the near middle distance, I suppose, 20, 25 kilometres away.
You can see a pretty good view of it anyway.
Lovely Provençal evening though, isn't it?
Yeah,
warm sun still, looking forward to some kind of nice...
bathing in the warm sunshine.
Yeah.
How was that?
Incredible. Unfortunately, I was up at the top here, and there's no screen to watch anything.
So you didn't see anything at all?
No. Everyone was sending me reports on WhatsApp.
But, you were able to follow it on Twitter?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I was just, you know, eventually we could see him looking down, coming up in the final kilometre, and it's just incredible. I mean, Mont Ventoux and the yellow jersey, you don't get much better than that.
Mm. When did you see Chris after he finished? Did you?
Basically, straight afterwards, they pulled him off to the side and managed to come through and got a big hug and a kiss.
That was Michelle Cound that you heard from there, the fiancée of Chris Froome, who was at the summit of Mont Ventoux today. Obviously, a very happy fiancée. Her man did the damage today. Thoughts on the stage, Daniel? You thought this would be. This could be boring. So did it live down to your expectations?
No, not really, because it was incredibly aggressive. It was so obvious when they were coming to the bottom of the Ventoux that it was going to blow apart in a spectacular way, but just purely because it was so fast and there were so many teams riding aggressively. I'm not sure what it is about this Tour de France which is made for such aggressive racing. I think it might have been that they slotted into that groove very early in Corsica and they sort of came... You know, arm to the teeth, almost ready for battle, and it's really continued in that vein the whole time. It's quite refreshing, actually.
It was obviously a stage where the French were desperate to feature prominently, weren't they? Were you surprised to see Pierre Roland being so aggressive so early?
Yeah, and apparently it upset some people. Is that correct?
Don't know.
I think he may have attacked when someone was relieving themselves, and I think he upset Chris Froome.
He upset people last year as well, didn't he, when he attacked
after the
Tackgate incident.
Yeah, I mean, he really is a worthy inheritor of Richard Wrong's mantle in so many different ways.
Yeah, and hopefully not
but
in
not,
all ways.
But not in all ways.
Lionel, thoughts on today's stage?
Well, it was extraordinary, really, wasn't it, to see the yellow jersey take such a... strong grip again on that race lead. There is no doubt he is the strongest rider going uphill.
By some margin.
No doubt whatsoever. Quintana, I thought, was impressive as well. But, you know, Froome, there was no... I don't think it would have crossed his mind to have gone all the way to the top of Quintana. He had his eyes on the stage win as well as taking as much time as possible overall.
He kept talking to Quintana, and I wondered at one point if he was saying, you know, you help me distance Contador, you can have the stage win. You know, these kind of deals have been hatched in the past, but clearly not. He was just trying to get him to go faster, I think.
No, that was his intention. Yeah. His intention was to give the stage to Quintana, but Quintana couldn't follow.
Is that right?
Yes.
Where do you hear that, Daniel? Because that's not what Froome said.
That's what Froome said in the press conference, Rich.
I was in the press conference. He didn't say that.
I think he did. Were you sure you were paying attention?
I thought I was paying attention, but I was maybe too busy holding a Twitter spat.
Or he might have said that in the mix zone. He certainly dropped heavy hints to that effect.
I didn't pick up on that.
We all know the
apologies.
Rules. No gifts on Mont Ventoux.
No gifts.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
We were up on the mountain, as we said, and we'll just play now a little clip of the sounds of Mont Ventoux. And of this was the... I just stuck my recorder out while... Froome went past. We were some distance from the crowd. We were on a ledge above the crowd, so we were a bit away from them. But the helicopter was overhead. You can hear the thwacking of the blades, and it was pretty dramatic. And hopefully, some of the atmosphere will come across in this clip. So that hopefully gives you an idea of what it sounds like up there when the race is passing. It is exciting, no matter how many times you witnessed it. It's kind of visceral kind of thrill once the helicopters are overhead and the crowd who've been waiting all day for this glimpse of the riders really kind of work into a frenzy as they come past.
That's right, you do feel that kind of wave of excitement coming up the mountain as the riders are approaching. And as many tours as we've been on and as many great races as we've seen, there's nothing quite like that atmosphere of being in amongst the crowd and being on the roadside and seeing and feeling really what the Tour de France is all about. I think it always sort of, it kind of jolts me again, I think, each time I see the Tour from such close quarters, just what an extraordinary event it is. You're driving up the climb through all of the crowds, thousands of people there. I know the estimates were pretty wide of the mark. There weren't a million people on Mont Ventoux today, but there were perhaps a couple of hundred thousand.
That's a bit pessimistic. That's a bit harsh, Lionel. It's a couple of hundred thousand.
Yeah, I think I would say there's two Wembley stadiums worth of people on that mountain.
What
today.
Do you think?
I think that's about.
Well, if they've estimated, possibly. I mean, I noticed they were a lot more spread out this time, because last time the Tour came up here in 2009, they pretty much stopped the fans at the Chalet Reynard. It's like 1450 meters above sea level, and they were very, very tightly packed in
and
the
they
bottom
were very
of the climb.
Up further up,
yeah,
they?
Very sparse. Yeah. Whereas today it was pretty much too deep the whole way up.
So what do you say then? 400,000?
I would say 300-400.
Yeah.
At least 215,000.
We're guessing. I mean, we're thrashing about like a man searching for power data.
Well, funny you should mention that, Lionel, because once again, Chris Froome's performance was so dominant.
This is upsetting me. This
is it.
I'm just exasperated by it. I just don't know where it's going to end. Rich.
Yeah, I mean, what you're meaning is that all the kind of times and the comparisons with Armstrong and the assumptions that are made based on the comparisons with Armstrong.
Well,
if those comparisons are accurate in the first place.
And just the assumptions that anyone who is sceptical of those calculations, there is some kind of ill will on their part, or there is some kind of, you know, bias. I mean, we're trying to be as objective
the
as possible.
The debate is very polarised.
Yeah,
you're either a doping apologist or you're an anti-doping crusader.
Yeah, I mean, and things are simple. Like, there were all sorts of statistics being bandied around tonight about set fragments of the climb. You know, and I was speaking to Jeremy Whittle from The Times, and, you know, we talked about things as simple as the fact that the Mont Ventoux used to have a notoriously rough road surface and a notoriously grabby, you know, road surface that didn't roll very well. That's been changed, and it makes a huge difference to any amateur rider. I can vouch for that, and we can probably all vouch for that. Those of us have ridden it, and you know, the fact also, for instance, just a tiny thing, but this just shows how cycling changes, that Armstrong wasn't wearing a helmet in 2002. You know, they're all wearing helmets now. It's, you know, just tiny things like that. But when you start to count them up and multiply them, you just realise how nonsensical, in my eyes anyway, the comparisons are.
Yeah, today, as we were waiting for after the finish and the stuff was being bandied about, you know, the news came through about Tyson Gay, the sprinter, testing positive, and there were. Doping became a kind of hot topic on Twitter, let's face it. And the thing is, this race, since last Saturday, when that talk cleared up after Froome's dominant performance at Trois Domaines, that it became an important but not the dominant subject. While the race took centre stage again, it has been a great race. Now we've got a week to go. If Froome is this dominant, it will be the dominant topic, won't it?
Well, it will. But the difficulty is that we're basing the suspicion of performance is what we're debating. Basically, we're looking at how somebody rides in the race and using that, almost sort of laying that sort of sheet of tracing paper over the history of the sport and trying to see where the patterns line up. And if you are of the mind that you think that dominant performance definitely equals doping, then you can see where the questions come from. My frustration is that Froome was asked in the press conference on the rest day whether he is doping, and he said no, he's not doping. Now, what more can he really sort of say? Does he have to say that after every stage win? Is it? Do we have to have the kind of back and forth, kind of, you know, almost like as a tennis rally, asking the same question time and time again and getting the same answer? Where does that actually get us?
I mean, on Froome, no investigative reporting is really. Well, it's very difficult to do any investigative reporting because we've not really been fed any kind of scraps to go on yet. I mean, with Armstrong,
that's how
the
investigations
world,
start.
Yeah,
you've heard something, or you're tipped off about something, or you have a suspicion that you follow.
Yeah,
that's what's kind of been lost, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, at the moment it seems like a war. It seems like the believers, non-believers. I think what there is here is we all share the same frustration that we can't know. Mm. And we all want to know because, you know, on a certain level, we're all suspicious. We're all, well, certainly sceptical. Mm-hmm. We're sceptical because of the history of the sport, and we're, by nature, sceptical of anyone who is dominant, like Lionel said. But the frustration is not being able to validate or verify those suspicions, not having the tools available, and also being sold, for instance, these comparisons as ways to ascertain.
And into that vacuum, yeah. This statistical information.
Yeah, and floods. It's not going to answer our questions.
No, and we feel that as journalists as well, I think, don't we? It gets us down that we are, you know, we are accused of not doing our jobs if he's not asked. There was a question today about whether he was asked about doping today. As you say, Lionel, a few days, he's been asked about it pretty much every day. If not directly, then indirectly, there are. That, you know, even a couple of days ago, he was asked about his power output in the time trial and so on.
The thing is, though, with Sky, and not to just kind of give them a sort of green light, but, you know, we've all been either at races behind the scenes or at training camps, and we've had, you know, the Tour de France is probably the worst place to have any kind of access to what's going on because it's the highest pressure point of the season where everybody is on the limit, and you know, it's the biggest, most pressured race of the year, and it's where the entire media circus turns up. And I can quite imagine if you were a journalist from another country who perhaps hasn't been to see Sky at some of the press events they've had, or been up to Manchester to meet these people and talk to them and actually build up, and I'm talking about over a number of years, not just this year, but, you know, going back to the genesis of the team. It's really hard to for us to say, well, look, we know, you know, we've covered these guys, and there have been things that have flagged up over the time. There have been points in all of our relationships with Team Sky, I'm sure, where we've not been flavour of the month. Perhaps me more so, that certainly in year one, when I had a pretty rocky, poor relationship with them. But, you know, we've been fairly persistent in trying to build relationships with people and actually ask the questions of, yeah, you know, what are the methods, and, you know, scratching away at the surface, keep scratching away at the surface. You would have expected to see something at this point that, you know, maybe it would be a rider who's left the team, you know, a disgruntled rider who's left the team.
Think of all the riders who left Armstrong's team and tested positive pretty soon after leaving Armstrong's team. I mean, I think the key thing as journalists, you try to be objective. You try not to make up your mind without knowing the facts. And there are a lot of people who have made up their minds. And I think that as journalists, we have a responsibility. I think what the Armstrong case showed as well is that after the event, after the fact with Armstrong, a lot of journalists said correctly that they knew stuff that they weren't able to tweet in particular or put out there in public or write in their articles. And so I think there's an assumption now that journalists know more than they're able to say publicly. And so I think it's very irresponsible if you're a journalist to hint on Twitter or anywhere else that you do know stuff. Some of our colleagues, I think, are guilty of that. And I sometimes pull them up for it. I just don't think it's responsible to do that. People can say what they like in Twitter and public forums, but I think if you're a journalist, if you're on this kind of inside, as it were, if you have access to these people to talk to them and so on, you know, put your questions to them. Don't don't put them out there on Twitter.
Well, it will be certainly interesting to see how things play out at the Sky press conference on the rest day tomorrow.
Well, on that subject, I mean, we spoke to Dave Brailsford at the summit today. He was happy, but quite tetchy, I think it's fair to say. He was like this last year at the tour. There were moments where the stress seemed to get to him a little bit. Not surprisingly, La Toussure last year, when Froome's acceleration caused some disharmony between him and Wiggins at the summit there, Dave was fairly, he sort of resorted to the sarcasm that he does sometimes when he's a little bit under pressure. And he did that again today, when he obviously is very sensitive to the criticism that there has been of his team, which we have
It's criticism of him, really, because we've raised questions about the selection, haven't we? And that ultimately comes down to him.
If you're listening, Dave, that was Daniel Freeb.
I think the thing is,
he knows what we think.
It's the job of a sports manager to pick a team and then basically defend that selection to the end. I mean, there's no point doing anything else. I mean, if you're the manager of the England cricket team selecting the lineup for the Ashes, or if you're Manchester United's manager, your selections are picked over, pored over every time you go onto the field. And it's no different, really, in the Tour de France. The selection of the eight riders to support Chris Froome is one of the key aspects of Sky's entire season. So it's not surprising that given the way they've ridden, that is going to come under scrutiny.
And
that's not necessarily a criticism of them as individuals overall. It's just an assessment of their form in this tour.
Well, were they better today? I mean, I thought that Peter Kenyuk once again was immense, really. Richie, when he swung over, having done his turn, he almost kind of came to a halt, actually. Richie Porte then took over. They are fortunate to have the best climber by some distance in their team, because Richie Porte was starting to slow at 7, and that's when 7 kilometres to go, and that's when Froome really took matters into his own hands, and he was able to.
I think the key thing on the team selection there, and what the other riders are doing, is we don't see everything that those other riders are doing, so I get the feeling there's been a bit of reassignment of roles in the team as the race is evolving, and people are who perhaps. Somebody like, say, David Lopez, who you would have expected to have played a bigger role on the climbs, has perhaps had his role reassigned, and they may well be very pleased with how he's adapted to being given a different role. But I don't think you could necessarily say that was the job we would have expected him to come into the tour to do.
And Rich, by normal standards, a team leader left on his own 8 kilometres from the top of a special category climb, that doesn't look great. You wouldn't say that's a fantastic team performance today.
Although there was only one other rider with them at the time,
but like you say, they're very lucky to have by far the strongest rider in the race, who's more than capable of looking after himself at the moment.
I mean, I thought Froome was very, it was impressive the way he seemed to be able to dictate what was going to happen on that climb to such an extent. I mean, he was talking to Richie Porte. We asked him afterwards what he was saying to him, and he was wanting Porte to go harder, and he did, and he isolated everybody apart from Contador. Contador was the only one that could go with the two of them at that point. I think he wanted him to just empty himself, and then he would take over, and he obviously had the confidence to do that. And then once he was up the road, he was talking. I asked Brailsford about this. He was talking all the time on his radio to the car, and was he just wondering where Contador was? Or, I don't know. He seemed to have energy to burn anyway. He seemed to be very much in control of the performance.
And there have been some very good individual performances by Sky. I mean, Kenyuk has been outstanding, really. Thought perhaps he was weakening this week, the latter part of this week, but today he was outstanding. They do seem reliant on those individual performances at the moment. That if Kenyuk hadn't been on a good day today, then I'm not sure who could have stepped in to do that job. They're really, I'm not going to say they're down to their bare bones, but with two guys out, Siutsu I don't think is on particularly great form. I don't think Lopez is maybe climbing as well as he would normally be climbing. So it's not going to be easy for them. It's still not going to be easy.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
A reminder that on humansinvent.com you will find lots of great cycling content, articles by the likes of Tom Southam, Rob Penn, an interview by Jack Thurston with Brian Cookson recently. Lots of really good stuff on there. We're going to just sort of look ahead to tomorrow's rest day. Rest day, second rest days, especially on the tour, are when a lot of sort of transfer business gets done, isn't it? There's a lot of... have you heard any juicy rumours?
Not too much this year. All the agents are saying that it's very, very quiet. I spoke to Alex Carrera, who has a number of Italian clients, and also Torhushov's Juan Antonio Fletcher a few days ago, but he's just had a baby, so he's been out of the picture for off the radar for a few days. But he said, was talking about Juan Antonio Fletcher is looking for a team, obviously because Vakhan Saleh look as though they're going to go down the... down the plug hole, don't they?
Isn't the issue a lack of money other than the big teams? Bacalos, funding of Amiga Pharma and Sky obviously have got plenty of money, but
yeah, and it's as far as the teams are concerned, it's a buyer's market. The odds are heavily stacked in their favour because the market's going to be flooded with riders from these teams. Escatel looking more and more likely that they might downsize or disappear, and Vakhan Saleh will probably disappear, so that's immediately almost, well, it's over 50 riders that will be on the market.
Well, last week I spoke to Andrew McQuaid, son of Pat McQuaid, the UCI president. Andrew is an agent himself, represents a number of riders, including Richie Port, Geraint Thomas, and a number of others. And I just asked him what his role entails and how important the Tour de France is in terms of getting business done for the transfer window when it opens in August.
How important is the Tour for you in your role?
Very important, because all the decision makers are here, all the team managers are here for most of the race, all the sponsors, all the big riders, so it's the most important event of the year and everyone's here.
So what kind of work do you do here? Is it just sort of meeting and greeting, and or is this where all the transfer deals are done for next season?
A lot of meeting and greeting. You can't actually sign a contract until the 1st of August, so it's just talking and negotiating. The tour essays are good for that, meetings, and every morning you talk to people.
So who are your sort of A-list clients here on the race?
Good few of the Team Sky boys, Richie, Grant, Pete and Ian, then Amel from BMC, Chris from Avell from Cofidis, a couple of other guys.
And in terms of sort of negotiation, how does that kind of play out? Did it just quite informal chats to start with, and then you get down to the real business a bit later in the summer?
It's pretty informal. Like, for the big riders, it's usually they know at this stage where they're going to go, so that's quite easy. And then it's trying to find out what teams are looking for, so it's informal chats if they're looking for a climber, a sprinter, domestic, whatever it is, and then try to fit people to what they need.
So it's not just about the size of the contract in terms of salary. There's a lot of other factors to take into account, such as how a rider would fit in with a team.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. It's no matter how much money a rider gets paid for a team, if he's not happy, it's not going to be worth it. So he needs to make sure the team fits the rider and vice versa.
And in a sport as political and sometimes fractious as cycling, I suppose human relationships are the most important thing. So you've got to be able to get on with everybody, whether it's the team owners and director sportifs and riders. So is that where these relationships are formed?
Yeah, these races and all the early season races, it's all races throughout the year. That's why I travel a lot to them, just to, even if it's a 5-minute chat, it's worth it just to build that relationship.
And in terms of getting new recruits, new riders to represent, how does that work? Is there quite a bit of rivalry between you and the other agents? I can think of Alex Carrera, who's got an equally impressive client list. So are you looking to sort of poach people from other representatives?
I wouldn't say poach. At the moment, the main focus is getting a young rider when they're before they've got a manager, and checking out the talent, seeing who's good, and trying to get them. That's what most agents seem to do, as opposed to go and try poach riders.
Right. So in that case, are you keeping a real close eye on sort of under 23 scene and all of that kind of thing, trying to predict who the next riders will be?
Yeah, it's all the big races, the Olympias, Turingen, all those type of races. You're keeping an eye on those results.
So how was it, for example, somebody like Richie Port, who you represent, how did you kind of develop that relationship from the start? You obviously spotted he was a talent.
It was when he was an amateur, he won a stage in the Baby Giro, and someone recommended it to him, but he already kind of had a kind of manager at the time. But I struck up a relationship with him, and then I kind of helped him with some other stuff, and then he needed a proper manager, so he came to me.
And just in terms of sort of managing a rider's kind of day-to-day lives outside of the Tour de France, do you come into that as well, you know, managing contracts with potential sponsors and endorsements, that kind of thing?
We try to. It's hard for cyclists to get those type of deals. Normally their team or everything, that it's all tied up by all the team sponsors, and the team on a day-to-day basis look after their travel and accommodation and everything like that. But there is appearances and some corporate speaking in the winter, stuff like that, that we do for them.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
Here we are then in the shadow of Mont Ventoux, kind of. It's just over there behind Daniel's, on Daniel's shoulder, actually. So final part of the podcast. We're going to hear in a minute from someone who will be busy on the rest day.
No?
Matt Rabin, the chiropractor with Garmin Sharp.
Where is Chiro?
Well, let's hear from Chiro now.
And now, Pedaleur de Charme.
Thank you, Chiro. Pedaleur de Charme, any nominations?
Can I go for a Pedaleur sans charme?
Oui.
Without charm tonight. Yeah. I noticed today, Balcom Olimar, he's the reincarnation of Fernando Escarpin.
Yes, I thought that as well.
He really is.
Yes.
The hunchback and the very pointy nose. He really is exactly like him.
He's like a crab.
He can't help sideways up the mountain. He's a very nice chap by all accounts. But
Fernando
really
Escarpin was a Kelmy climber of the 90s,
really,
wasn't he?
Crab-like climber, wasn't he?
Not pretty to watch.
No.
Yeah, Malema, I think he was right on the limit there. That always brings out the worst, sort of. I, speaking from personal experience, I know that when I'm tired, I lose my silky smoothness and look less than...
I can vouch for that, Richard.
You've never seen me ride my bike.
No, I was thinking more generally.
And you've seen me ride my bike, Daniel, but not in my pop.
Depleted.
Yeah, I was riding on one leg at the time.
I hope so. Because the wattage that day wasn't very impressive.
Deliberate. I didn't want any suspicion. Lionel, any Pedaleur de Charme?
Well, to be honest, it was about the two men that just danced up the climb, Froome and Quintana. I mean, they...
You are giving a Pedaleur de Charme award to Chris Froome. Wow.
Well, no, not necessarily, but, I mean,
He's effective.
He is incredibly effective. He's almost like a chameleon with his pedalling style, isn't he? I mean, depending on what position his hands are on the bars, it all looks completely different. It's like a shape-shifting, some kind of... I'm struggling a bit here, but he's a sort of chameleon figure. Looks different every time you look at him. Whereas,
did we decide what pasta shape he most resembled?
No, I don't think we did.
Was he not? Who was Fusilli?
I can't remember. But Fusilli, it might have been. No, I think we said Froome was more like linguine.
Linguine, perhaps. Yeah. Whereas Quintana would be Penny.
Anyway, it's been a long tour.
Quintana, smooth as anything. Again, looked very good. Dan Martin of Garmin Sharp, as he slid out the back, again, sort of Escartine like. Yes.
He's kind of nodding. Yeah, a bit more like a woodpecker.
He looks like he's not really...
In fact, a woodpecker wouldn't be a bad nickname for Dan Martin, the woodpecker.
He looks like he's got a 9 centimetre stem or something. It looks very kind of hunched up on the bike. It's not really stretched out. It's just his style.
Do you like that woodpecker?
That's good.
Yeah, I like that. Quite like that.
Get that going.
I remembered as up on Mont Ventoux today. I can't remember if you were there, Daniel, but the last time I was there in 2009, I found myself standing at the Tom Simpson Monument with Tom Simpson's daughter. She appeared.
Yes.
I was there with Peter Cousins.
Yes.
And she appeared, and she'd ridden up the mountain. Then Greg LeMond appeared over the hill.
Yes.
And he had a chat with Tom Simpson's daughter. Were you there?
No, I was down the mountain again.
That was a very memorable incident. Yeah, Greg LeMond was up there again today.
Yeah, I saw him in a very nice Lacoste polo shirt. Going back to Dan Martin.
Pedaleur de Charme, Greg LeMond.
Going back to Dan Martin, this is something I've always meant to ask the Garmin Sharp riders. They call him Crosswinds, and I'm not sure whether this is sarcastic. Yeah, his nickname, it certainly was for a period, it was Crosswinds, and I'm not sure whether that is some slight on his ability in those conditions, or whether he's surprisingly... good.
Interesting little thing. I'm just thinking about Greg LeMond. I don't think he would ever have ridden up Mont Ventoux in the Tour de France, would he?
He might have ridden up in the Tour de France, Richard, but I'm not sure about the Tour de France.
Don't. That's a form of, you know, racism to pick on my accent, Daniel.
Would
less
he not?
Of the anti-Scottishness, please.
98. No, you're right, Richard. 87.
He wouldn't have been there. So I don't think he would have ridden up Mont Ventoux. No, he might have done it in the Dauphiné.
Get this far in the 94 Tour, did he?
I've seen him on the summit twice during the Tour.
That's remarkable.
Great
stuff.
Pub quiz question, maybe. Mm. So that's Pedaleur de Charme. I'll nominate Jonathan Hivert, who was last man up the climb.
What about Sagan's wheelie?
Oh, God, yes. Sagan's wheelie was great just before he was caught by the bunch. A Garmin Sharp rider as well. I think it might have been Jack Bauer.
Yeah.
Did a great wheelie going past the kind of VIP bit just near, about 150 metres from the summit.
Yeah.
Sustained it for a good 20, 30 metres. And then handoff, waved at the crowd. Terrific response to that. I think it was Jack Bauer.
If it was, and we were talking about Jack Bauer, weren't we? Because in, what is it, 3 years, he's gone from the Tour Series
he's
of
gone
Criterium
from
races.
In a hit American TV series. But he's also, before that, he was a personal trainer in New Zealand and a bike courier not long before that. Now, the guy that told me that was somebody we'll hear from now. I did an interview the other day with Matt Rabin, who is a chiropractor, not a... role that every team has, chiropractor, but he's worked with Garmin Sharp for a few years now, and I just asked him a little bit about his work and why he is particularly useful.
Well, he's considered to be one of the top 15 chiropractors in professional cycling.
Yeah, and also he'll be busy tomorrow, I imagine, on the rest day.
I'm here with Matt Rabin outside the Garmin Sharp team bus. Now, Matt is a chiropractor at Garmin Sharp. How long have you worked with the team, Matt?
6 years, 7 years, since 2008.
Am I right in thinking that when Bradley Wiggins joined the team in 2009, you two realised you'd been at school together?
We did realise we'd been at school together. Well, actually, a mutual friend of ours, Gary Beckett, was talking to me during 2006 when I was working at the Track Worlds with the American team. He said about this lad that Brad was from London. I thought he was from Manchester, and he said, no, he's from London. He's from your neck of the woods. I said, where's that? He said, Maidervale, Kilburn, round there. I said, oh, what school did he go to? So he texted him, asked him what school he went to. I said, it wasn't the red-headed chap in the year below me with
He's year below you.
He was year below me with the Kenny Dalglish trench coat that all the kids wanted, and he had it. So I remembered this ginger lad in the year below called Brad, and he remembered me being a year above, and that was it. Random, like, very random, 20 years later, ended up on the same team.
Did he not remember you as a bit of a bad lad? Is that...
So the story goes, but that's just, I think age has clouded his memory for the negative there.
So tell me more seriously about your work. How many days a year do you work with the team, and what does your work involve?
Do 100 days in the year with the team, travelling around with them to races, training camps, and then also sort of try and do some things from home whereby we oversee injury management and making sure that our riders get to the right people at the right time to... be it physios, chiros, osteopaths, whatever they need, and try and liaise with their people when we need to make sure they're getting the help they need. And then on races, it's basically either trying to put out fires, like for example on the tour, you might have an injury or niggle that comes up 2 or 3 days into the race, but it's a Tour de France, so you can't just quit and give it 2 or 3 days to rest. So you just got to try and put the fire out, nip things in the bud early doors. Longer term stuff, if you've got guys that injured, trying to liaise with them and make sure that they sort of get through it and see the outcome that is getting back on the bike and being back to their best.
You work with footballers as well, don't you?
I wouldn't say I work with footballers per se. It's a very small part of what I do, but last season I was just down at West Ham. I did a little bit of work up at Everton with one or two players. In sport, the majority of my sporting working chiro life is with these guys.
But you must have experience of having worked with other elite athletes as well. And how do cyclists compare to them? How do the demands of the sport compare to...
Well, the thing about cycling is, like, if you're on a race will be the, 1 week stage race, or a tour, a 3 week stage race, something like this. It's different to a lot of sports because you'll have crashes or you'll have injuries come up, and you can't give it that rest. So a lot of the papers and the studies on sports injuries and stuff will say, you need to rest it for X, Y, Z, or give it 2 or 3 days rest or what have you. But you don't really have, we're not really afforded that luxury in this sport. So it's a case of doing everything you can to reset them back in 12 hours, for the next stage and get them back on their bike. Because ultimately, everyone wants to try to get to Paris at the Tour. Everyone wants to try and get through to, the end of a stage race.
How does that, in your normal practice, I would imagine that rest would be something you would prescribe as well. So how, as a chiropractor, a medical man, how does that almost inhuman demands put on riders at this level, how does that sit with your kind of medical training and your normal practice?
The two kind of dovetail really well, because the human body is a human body fundamentally. These are guys just pushing themselves that much harder and that much longer than people who I would see in everyday practice. But if someone's got a back problem or a neck problem, then the treatment is not a million miles different, because the body is what the body is, so you're sort of dealing with the same template. It's just that you need to get things accelerated on these races, because it's all about dealing with the pain and optimising performance and making sure that function is adequate in order to perform. That's the same sort of things that people are looking for in everyday life, but more often than not, in everyday life, you're dealing with more sort of, in everyday practice, chronic issues that have been there for a long period of time. So you want to try and, you are afforded the luxury of a little bit more time with them over a long period of time and seeing them progression through to rehab and all this.
Are there occasions, though, where you really feel that a rider should stop? And in that, on those occasions, is that the advice you would give the rider and indeed the team?
Standing as part of the medical team, my role is to give, you know, the advice to the rider and to some of the the management staff as well, along with the doctor, who will do the same sort of thing. But we stand together and sort of usually try and have a similar sort of message to give the rider.
Come so to some consensus.
Come to some you. Consensus. However, you know, it's not unusual in this sport that a rider will say, you know what, I want to carry on going, and you go, well, you know, that, you know, you're aware of the pitfalls and the pros and the cons of it, and as long as it's typically safe for them to do so, if they can bear the pain, then more often than not, the last call will usually come with a rider. Normally.
Do many teams have chiropractors?
4 or 5 teams that I know, but there are a lot of other teams that use them intermittently. Yeah. And some riders will have their own guy, and he might be a chiropractor or an osteopath who do some of this sort of things, or you might get specific sort of practitioners with individual riders who, if they're on a race, they might come. Like some of the bigger riders on different teams have guys who bring with them to races.
Why a chiropractor, not an osteopath?
Well, that's a very good question. And to be honest, I would say the two aren't mutually exclusive, in so much as if you've got, you want to get a good of either. It doesn't really matter if they're a chiropractor, what their title is, chiropractor or osteopath, or physio for that matter. You want to get somebody that A, has the skill set to assist the riders, that riders have confidence in. That's more important than what their title is.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore, Daniel Freib and Lionel Burney.
So that was Matt Rabin. As we were listening to Matt there, I realised that I hadn't explained why Jonathan Iver was my pedaler de charme, so apologies for that. He was last on the stage, 50 minutes, 21 seconds down, but still in the time limit. But he was a good 18 minutes behind the last man in the gruppetto. He had the broom wagon following him all the way up the climb. It looked, poor guy, but he did well.
He must have been dropped before the climb, I would
Sodger
have thought.
Son,
he
yeah.
must have
50
been
minutes.
Back,
you would hope so, wouldn't
yeah.
you?
To lose 50 minutes, or he lost, how many minutes would he have to lose per kilometre?
On the climb?
Well, he would have had to be dropped.
Nearly
2.5. Yeah, he'd have had to stop for a beer or something.
I think he probably stopped for a Magnum ice cream.
Oh, Lionel. Lionel stops for Magnum ice cream every day. Right, the only other business we've got is to remind you of our competition to win a phone call from Jonathan Vauters on tomorrow's rest day. It is, what is it? Oh yeah,
it's about his nickname.
Hashtag Votter's nickname. Oh, no. And if you tweet that to @humansinvent, and the winner will be drawn out of a hat.
It's not the dreaded nickname that
tomorrow.
Every sportsman who has read a book. Wears glasses
I don't think
gets,
it is. Although I've seen a few guesses to that.
Okay, thing. Let's hope not.
But anyway, that phone call will be happening tomorrow. I'm sure Humans Invent will be organising that as we speak. And I think the cut-off time is 12 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah, we're suffering a bit with the mistral here, aren't we?
We are, it's quite windy, yeah. So we'll wrap up. But Daniel, you're off now.
Yeah,
that's
I've
it.
Got to
Your
go back.
Your tour's over.
I've got to go back. It's the first one I haven't finished for
young
over
riders,
a decade.
Young riders often only do sort of the first till the second rest day. And then
that's true, that's true.
Save yourself. You've got a long career ahead of you.
What are you doing?
You don't want to burn out.
Are you doing the Vuelta or the Worlds? What's next?
Maybe the Worlds, maybe Tour of Poland.
Daniel, why are you going home?
I've got to write a book.
What book is it?
It's a secret book.
It's a sequel.
Yeah, it's a secret sequel.
It's a secret sequel book.
It's one of the rare cycling books that's not authored by Richard Moore.
Oh.
That's all you need to know.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we'll look forward to that.
We'll soldier on, won't we, Richard? With
we're going to soldier on. We're not going to soldier on. We're going to beef it up. We're going to make it better.
No.
We're going to. Daniel's no loss at all. He's no Kirienka. You know, we can replace him.
Oh,
We can. We're going to bring in guests. Every day, from Chiro to Tan Man to Wealth. We're going to get a couple of females as well.
Who?
Just people, Daniel.
Who?
Just females. Orla Chenoui, when she arrives. We're going to get Fran Miller, Operations Director at Team Sky. I might just do an interview with her, or I might get her on the podcast. But we've had a few people asking about women's cycling. There's a bit of a movement for a women's Tour de France. So we want to discuss that with them. Not that we can't have a valid view
well,
on that.
There
as well.
Had been a women's Tour de France in the 80s.
Yes.
It was successful for a while, and then it got shelved when they wanted to basically beef up the Tour de France in terms of making it more efficient and profitable.
Don't you waste all your best stuff on this, Lionel?
I've got more.
We've got loads to talk about on that. We're going to take a day off tomorrow, the rest day, and then we'll be back on Tuesday. And thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel. Any last words?
No, not really. Thanks. It's been a pleasure and a privilege. Until next year, hopefully.